Hi, everybody. Today is Thursday, August 28, 2025, and our friend Alex Craner is back with us. Welcome back, Alex.
Thank you, Nima. Always good to join you.
Alex, let me start with this question. Looking at Europe today, what is the biggest threat that you feel about the future of Europe and what's going on right now in Europe?
Well, I think that the biggest threat is the dominance of the money lending oligarchies that are still in control of the political class in most of the European countries. And I think it's quite clear from historical precedents, but also from their stated policy objectives, that they are going to force Europe into an all-out war against Russia. And the preparations for this war are going to include a new cycle of economic immiseration of the population, militarization and Nazification. And, you know, the reason why I say economic immiseration of the population, it's because people in general are not so keen on confrontation and on war when they're prosperous and when things are looking good in their societies. They become agitated when things are just awful everywhere. And then, you know, what you get is you get very high unemployment, especially very high youth unemployment. You have hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of young men with nothing to do, with no future, with no hopes of buying their homes, having meaningful jobs, raising families, getting married, having children, and so forth. And that's your dry tinder. That's your cannon fodder for war. And you need millions of those. And so I think that the economic devastation of Europe is going to continue deliberately. And then the ruling class is going to keep on fear-mongering against Russia and making sure that this war in Ukraine doesn't die, that it continues, and that, you know, come 2028, 29, 2030, European nations can join the fight directly rather than just by proxy, because by then, you know, we will have run out of the last Ukrainian, and then the war will die. But now, you know, it seems that the war might die well before 2028. And so that creates a huge problem. And I think that they are now accelerating preparations for a different war. And that different war might be focused on the Balkans. And I think that two lines of attack are now being developed as far as I can see. One of them is in Bosnia, a confrontation with Serbia. And the other one might be the confrontation between Greece and Turkey, in which then, you know, Israel might play a role as an adversary to Turkey, because as it is, you know, in Syria, Turkey and Israel are stuck on what looks like an irreversible collision course, one against the other. And so right now, it seems that Greece is being armed to their teeth for a future confrontation with Turkey. You know, we've seen in Europe, Donald Trump has had to push very, very hard to get European countries to increase their military defense spending. And they were kicking and screaming to reach 2%. And now they're planning 5%, you know, somewhere along the future. But this is an almost impossible goal. Greece is already at 3.8% of the GDP in military spending, and this is being done with the assistance of NATO, of the UK, and Israel, and it's being done practically overtly as a preparation for a showdown against Turkey. And then Turkey has, I'm not sure how formal it is, but it has some kind of a defense pact with Albania and it has also military cooperation arrangements with the Republic of North Macedonia, the former Yugoslavian Republic of Macedonia. And it seems that all of these countries have military cooperation agreements with Great Britain. And then recently, this year at some point, Croatia entered into a military alliance with Albania, which is then linked with some form of military alliance with Turkey, and with Bulgaria. Croatia is now in a military alliance with Albania and Bulgaria. And then in February of this year, Great Britain also signed a military cooperation agreement with the government of Bosnia and Herzegovina, which is where the confrontation against Serbia might get sparked, because in Bosnia and Herzegovina, you have three constituent nationalities. You have Serbs, who are Orthodox Christians. You have Croats, who are Catholics. And you have the Muslims, which have been increasingly radicalized, because Muslims in former Yugoslavia were a minority, but they were not even, they were practically not noticeable. You know, they looked like you and I, and unless you asked, you didn't know that they were Muslims, men and women. Now, the Wahhabi current has taken over in Bosnia and Herzegovina, and now these Wahhabi groups are starting to be used to stage provocations, and foreign-funded NGOs and private contractors are being used to fund these groups who are staging provocations. So we have now very strange circumstances where, you know, you had about 2-3 weeks ago, you had an escalation of anti-government demonstrations in Belgrade. And the Serbian intelligence agencies determined that these protests were being funded from Croatia, which makes no sense whatsoever. You know, Croatia as a government and as a people and as a state has no reason to go undermine Serbia. It would be like, you know, setting your own block on fire. And then there were several provocations set up between Muslims and Croats, where, you know, you had these burqa clad women come into a 100% Croatian village and then set up to pray in a public place. And somebody was taking a video. And then some local came there and said, like, hey, what are you doing here? Get the hell out of here. And then this video circulates. And then some Wahhabi group planned to bring 1,000 Muslims to pray in this 100% Croatian village. And then Croatian intelligence agencies determined that that was being funded from Serbia, which also makes no sense whatsoever. You know, Serbian government, the Serbian state, has no reason to provoke the Croats in this way. So somebody is doing it. And then if you'll remember what happened in Georgia not so long ago, that Georgian government said, okay, if you have an NGO, if you have like some kind of a quasi-independent private organization that's receiving more than 25% of its funding from abroad, you have to declare the sources of that funding. And then the Western governments lost their heads. How dare they? This is against democracy and blah, blah, blah. But you can now see the reasons. Because if you have like NGOs from Croatia funding provocations against Serbia, and then NGOs from Serbia funding provocations against Croatia and against Croats in Bosnia, then it would be nice to find out, where do these NGOs get their funding? Where does the money ultimately come from? Where, well, you know, they don't have to declare it. In Georgia, they have to declare it now, but here they don't have to declare it. So all you see is Croats provoking Serbs, Serbs provoking Croats, and the pot is being stirred for a future conflict. And then I presume that similar things will be happening in Turkey, in Lebanon, on Cyprus, between the Cypriot Greeks and the Turks, and that the second front of the West's war against Russia will open in the Balkans, as the Rusi think tank said was inevitable. Rusi stands for Royal Information Services Institute. No, Royal United Services Institute, Rusi. One of the leading London-based think tanks, who said that opening of the second front in the war against Russia is inevitably going to open in the Balkans. So we now see this. Anyway, that's a long answer to your question, what's going on in Europe and what's worrying me the most. This is what's worrying me the most, because if unchecked, it could easily escalate to World War III and to a collective confrontation between the Western powers and Russia. And the Western powers at the moment excludes the United States, because Donald Trump said, thank you very much, I'm not doing this anymore. If you want to go to war, it's going to be without the United States. But, who knows what happens in another 3.5 years? Maybe we get some new Biden or Obama or Jake Sullivan or Anthony Blinken into the White House, and then the United States might join the war as well, which is why the Europeans are undeterred. They think we'll get rid of Trump somehow, but we have to push these wars anyway, and then, one way or another, we're going to be able to get the Americans on board, as we did in World War I and World War II, and we'll get it done now as well, in spite of the fact that they have no chance in a confrontation against Russia, but they're doing it anyway, because they think, like, somehow we'll finagle it and get the Americans involved again, and then we can have a splendid new World War III again, and hopefully at the end of it, we're going to emerge as victors, as peacemakers, we're going to provide credit for reconstruction and development, we're going to write history, and the history is going to say that this was like a dark period of confrontation between the evil Russians and Vladimir Putin, who's the new Hitler, and the European liberal democracies, who are the beacons of freedom and human rights and all those wonderful things. And so this is being planned, but in the meantime, there's a risk that A, European economies are going to be devastated, and that's already being done, and B, that again, tens of millions of people are going to die.
Alex, Medvedev said that Russia will take retaliatory measures if Austria joins NATO. When we look at Europe today, even during the Cold War, we didn't see that much of change that is happening right now with the case of Ukraine. Looking at if Austria, I think Austria would be the last unfortunate move that could happen in Europe. But we had Sweden, Finland, Switzerland losing its position in somehow being the common ground to talk, to negotiate, to, and you see Austria. I mean, what is the difference between the Cold War? We saw Finland surviving the Cold War and right now joining NATO and during the war in Ukraine. What is this war? It seems something much bigger than what we're talking about. It's a unbelievably huge issue in the mind of those people who are deciding about everything in the United States, I would argue, in the establishment of the United States and in Europe. Do we really see the bigger picture, what's going on there?
Well, I think we should, Nima. Okay, so first of all, I'll repeat again the big context. It's the conflict between two systems of governance, which explains a lot of things, and it explains even the difference between the Cold War between the West, the capitalistic West, and the communist bloc led by the Soviet Union. and the current conflict between the West and Russia, which is neither communist nor nor a single party dictatorship anymore. The difference is that during the Cold War, the Soviet Union, this is my very strong impression, the Soviet Union was actually a controlled opposition. You know, so they put the world into this polarized state so that they could, you know, if you have an enemy, a really credible, dangerous enemy, then it gives a certain coherence, a certain cohesiveness to the societies. It makes it easier for the ruling establishments to control their populations because there's an external enemy. But at the very highest levels of the political hierarchy, those two enemies actually worked in concert. So the very top of the Soviet ruling establishment and the very top of the Western ruling establishment were not really enemies. They cooperated, and they cooperated in the most important ways, in the most high priority policies, but they let the lower levels have it out, you know, on ideological basis, communists versus capitalists. And, you know, it made it appear that the hostility was real. It made it possible for both sides to feed enormous amounts of capital into the military-industrial complex and to, again, to keep a certain cohesiveness to their respective societies. This all fell apart in 1991. And today's Russia is not controlled opposition, it's real opposition. And so this is why, you know, whereas during the Cold War, the United States and Britain and France and so forth, all these Western powers were able to talk to their Soviets, and they were able to hold summits and meetings and sign nuclear disarmament treaties and intermediate nuclear forces treaties and all these different things. And the Soviets were able to trade in euro dollars. All their foreign trade was basically in euro dollars, which were mostly in London. So it wasn't a problem for the Soviets to keep their, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars worth of their money in London. Whereas today, it all is a problem in reality, because Russia, together with China, is now pulling the direction of global, you know, economic and political and cultural and financial and monetary development away from the Western paradigm. And they're trying to create a completely new paradigm. And so now the Western powers are in a bit of a panic, particularly since Trump took over, because Trump is now also joining forces with the Russians and the Chinese, even though he's doing it covertly. So a lot of people are confused about what the hell Trump is doing, but I think he is doing it for real. And so now they're in a panic. And so therefore, you know, you have a lot of these countries that used to be neutral, and their neutrality didn't matter, to now it's all hands on deck. Finland, guess what? You can't be neutral anymore. You have to join us. You're with us or you're against us. Switzerland, same thing. Austria, same thing. You're with us or you're against us. It's an all hands on deck moment. I think that fortunately, all these governments that are now declaring allegiance to the Western system of governance, to this neo-colonialist system, and ready to confront Russia militarily if need be, they have very, very little support in their populations. So I don't see this going very far, especially if the United States persists in its change of course in their policies. So if the, you know, like if Britain and France and Germany and all these little pipsqueak countries remain on their own and daddy abandons them, you know, daddy, the United States, then I think that ultimately they're going to be swept out of power. You're going to see a disintegration of the European Union. You're going to see a disintegration of NATO. And I think that governments individually, one by one, in you know, Hungary, Romania, Poland, Germany, France, and so forth, they're going to chart a new course. And I think that inevitably they will have to consider joining the BRICS movement. They're going to have to embrace the multipolar integrations. They're going to have to leave this unipolar idea of us against everybody else behind. And then we're going to see a complete transformation of the global order.
Yeah. Alex, I don't know if you saw the article in Politico. They're talking about five wars that could break out in the next 5 years. And the first one is Russia versus NATO in the Baltics. And you go along, you see Pakistan, India, Taiwan, China, India. The thing that I'm not finding in these five wars that they're picturing for us is, and then even they're talking about North Korea and South Korea, there is nothing about Iran and Israel. And in this article, on the other hand, we've seen the British government looking for I don't know if they've signed or they're in the process of signing a strategic deal partnership with Armenia. You know, it seems to me that the war between Iran and Israel, in the mind of those people who were somehow, they were thinking that they can overthrow the government in Iran, they lost their hope in Israel and the way that Israel may do something in Iran. And the proxies are coming to the northern part of Iran, to the southern part of Russia. Armenia, why does Armenia need to have a strategic partnership with the British government?
This is an excellent question, Imam. And I'm not sure I know the answer, but you know, I was myself stunned in February of this year when I saw that the government of Bosnia and Herzegovina signed a military cooperation agreement with Great Britain, because that makes no sense whatsoever. You know, Bosnia and Herzegovina is nearly landlocked country in the Balkans. Great Britain is an island in the Atlantic. Great Britain has a minuscule army. They have, you know, let's call it a respectable military industry, but without great capacity to deliver weapons in large amounts, you know. So, and without the capacity, you know, you can deliver some weapons, but if there's a war, those weapons get used up very quickly. So you would need an uninterrupted logistics chain to continue provide, because, you know, it's not like you give people weapons. You have to train people on using that weapons. You need to train them on maintaining and repairing those weapons systems. And so you have to put in motion like a whole system that can't just get blocked because, oh, the supplies have run out. And now what? Now we have to invent some new solution. So for this military cooperation to make sense, you would have to be able to have relatively robust logistical chains between the British military industry and Bosnia and Herzegovina, which is practically an impossibility. So I thought, what on earth is this all about? Why would the government of Bosnia and Herzegovina need a military cooperation agreement with Great Britain? And then I took a few minutes to just check out, because I knew that Britain had a military cooperation agreement outside of the scope of NATO with countries like France and Poland and Sweden. And then I did like a quick internet search to see what other similar agreements existed. And I came up with about 20, like that, you know, like you start, Britain signs a military cooperation agreement with, and then you have Denmark, Holland, Sweden, Norway, Poland, Moldova, Albania, Bosnia, France, Greece. It's like all over the place. And recently, for the first time, I think ever, or at least in a very, very long time, Britain signed a similar agreement with Kazakhstan, and then they sent a military attaché to Kazakhstan, which, you know, they never had this sort of a relationship. But again, you know, Kazakhstan is there in the middle of the Eurasian continent, completely landlocked, whereas Britain is this little pipsqueak military in the Atlantic Ocean. So it seems to me that the whole point of all these arrangements is exactly to stir the pot, to provoke confrontations, to trigger military confrontation and destabilize the target countries. And you know, this has been the British, basically the essence of British geopolitics since the early 1800s. And in the 1800s, the British signed many secret treaties with other countries. So, you know, they would sign a secret treaty with one country, with like Ottoman Turkey, and then they would sign a secret treaty with their adversaries, and then they would encourage them both to go to war against one another, and then support both sides against one another. And so they were doing this routinely. This is how Britain actually earned themselves the nickname the Perfidious Albion, because they were doing this as a matter of course. And then, you know, they would make friendly overtures with one country and then pit them against the other. And then when the first country became victorious and now became more powerful, then they would start making a friendly overture to the defeated power and start encouraging them so that they would keep everybody weak, disunited, and easily manipulated and controlled. And so it seems to me that, you know, that same playbook, you know, since Britain no longer has a military that can project real power, they're using these kind of playbooks, and they are implementing this through intelligence services, through like soft power, you know, intelligence services, non-government organizations that are everywhere, like hundreds of them practically in every country. They have these private contractors that are almost invariably funded by the British Foreign Office or MI6, or, you know, some of their offshore private entities. But you know, if you were able to trace the money all the way, you would probably always get to the British Foreign Office to organizations like MI6. And you know, we've already seen this happen in, you know, in Syria and Lebanon, in Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Somalia, Myanmar. And you know, all of these things, all of these places, what they have in common is that they ended up experiencing regime changes, coups, civil wars, or outright wars against, you know, between Saudi Arabia and Yemen, between Syria and, you know, these terrorist proxy forces that are also ultimately supported by the British, like HTS. And so I think that this is their last hurrah, their endeavor to retain hegemony over Eurasian landmass. They don't have the military to do it. The United States is no longer on board. So all they can do is continue these arson attacks against peace. And I think that the five that Politico listed may seem like the most likely ones. But I think that there are many others. You know, there's always Azerbaijan, Armenia, Greece, Turkey. There's no shortage of these crisis flashpoints that could emerge. And so, you know, it's unless you know the opposing powers like Russia, China, the United States, Iran, and others find strength and wisdom to push back against this, we might see more escalations in some of those flashpoints. And my fear is that it might involve Greece, Turkey, and the Balkans.
Alex, it seems that it's part of a process of just trial and error on the part of the British or the establishment in the West, because you look at, they go after, you see the war in Ukraine and what's going on in the Middle East. They try to do color revolutions, all of these movements. Navalny, look at what has happened in Russia, and the color revolution in Iran. And with the case of China, they try to do something with Uyghurs. But it seems that they're running out of options. That's why they're trying, instead of dealing, they're going after. You see what's going on in Bangladesh and these landlocks, and they're trying to do something in Armenia, as you've mentioned, in Europe. You know, these states, or somehow they feel, or the West sees them as insignificant, but they can be used against other powers. This seems to me the last step in their agenda, because what else they can do?
Yeah, I agree with that, Nima. I think it's panic, because, you know, for example, I was kind of very perplexed about the recent outbreak of hostilities between Armenia and Azerbaijan. And then, you know, Azerbaijan kind of at some point moving really to antagonize both Iran and Russia at the same time. And that seemed very, very dangerous. But I thought, well, if this was a good card to play, they would have played it much sooner. Instead, they played the Ukraine card, which is, you know, the same general region. But for some reason, you know, already in 1991, they started to begin laying the groundwork to confront Russia through Ukraine. And they started weaponizing Ukraine and building up, you know, the forces for that war. So obviously, they determined that that was a strong card to play. And then, you know, Azerbaijan, even though, you know, Azerbaijan is very much in the orbit of the Mossad and MI6 and the you know, Western corporation, oil corporations and all this, they only played that card this year after it became obvious beyond any doubt that the Project Ukraine was being lost. So I, in spite of the fact that looked like a very dangerous development, I thought that that was probably a very, very weak card to play. And in fact, you know, nothing much came of it. And I suspect that, you know, Trump making peace between Armenia and Azerbaijan and then getting the concession on the Zangezur corridor, I thought, you know, that at first blush, it looked like it's putting a stick in the works of Iran and Russia. Okay, it gives him negotiating leverage to an extent, even though it's just a piece of paper, right? You would need to actually deploy troops and weapons and defend it. And you know, if you don't have escalatory dominance in Ukraine, what escalatory dominance can you possibly have in the sandwich between Russia and Iran? But let's say it gives him some leverage, some negotiating leverage, but it completely risks to undermine the British-Turkish project of Greater Turania. And just for your viewers, as a reminder, you know, the Greater Turania is basically the project of uniting in some way, economically and politically, all the Turkic people from Turkey all the way to China. That, you know, it's a huge area that stretches through the center of the Eurasian continent, and that includes most of the stans. I made a mistake the last time I said that Uzbekistan was part of that. I think one of those stans is not a Turkic country, but most of them are, like, you know, yeah, Turkey, and then you have Azerbaijan, and from there you have
Uzbekistan, I think, is part of the Turkic people, and Tajikistan, yeah, may not be part of, yeah. Tajikistan,
maybe,
is,
yeah,
not,
but
Tajikistan is not part of the Turkic people.
Okay, yeah, Tajikistan, but you have the Turkmen, you know, Azerbaijan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan. It goes all the way to China, and so the British, who were trying to bring Turkey on board both on Project Syria and on Project Ukraine, were promising Erdogan in Turkey that they would support him in realizing this project of Greater Turania, that he would become the great, you know, leader and uniter of the Turkic peoples and blah, blah, blah. And so I guess, you know, maybe that appealed to him. Erdogan was close friends with with the head of the MI6, Sir Richard Moore, who used to be ambassador to Turkey, speaks fluent Turkish. And so their objective was to get Turkey, which is a NATO country, which has the second largest military force in NATO, to join the coalition against Russia, and to join, obviously, to help them overthrow Bashar al-Assad in Syria. And then the quid pro quo was, hey, we'll support you with the Greater Turania project. I don't know why Erdogan even considered this. It's like they never read history. The British do this all the time. They make promises they have no intention of honoring whatsoever. All you risk to do is to destroy your country. And I think that Erdogan now is pretty much on the way to doing just that. And if you notice, Turkey kind of vanished from all foreign policy developments, because, you know, you do have this confrontation between the two systems of governance, let's say, between the globalists and the rest of the world. And you see that the Iranians are shuttling between, you know, China, Russia, Saudi Arabia. The Saudis are talking to the Russians. Everybody is involved. Erdogan is practically out of the loop completely. And now he's up to his eyeballs in the morass that they created in Syria. He's on a collision course with Israel, and they are now very, very worried about the coming war with Greece. And part of it is now being built up in Cyprus, because you have a lot of Israelis who are now coming to Cyprus, who are buying properties on both sides, the Greek side and the Turkish side, and who are talking about Cyprus as part of the new Eretz Israel. Well, not new. It's kind of always been regarded as the future part of Israel. And they are looking to evict the Turks from Cyprus. So now the Turks have to boost their military presence on Cyprus, which at present is about 40,000 troops, and they're planning to increase that to more than 100,000. And the immediate conflict is obviously going to be against the Greek Cypriot side. And now there's voices increasingly louder in Turkey saying, hey, we should clear that. We should like take the whole of Cyprus. And so I think, you know, all of that could erupt at any point. But, you know, the mess is so complex. It's such a Gordian knot because, you know, the United States is now on practically hostile terms with Turkey, but they're allied in NATO. At the same time, the United States is allied with the Kurds. They still have their Free Syrian Army, which controls a small part of Syria still today. The United States is allied with Israel. Israel is on a collision course against Turkey. The Brits are in cahoot with Turkey in Syria, but they're also in cahoots with Greece against Turkey. And it seems to me that this is complete chaos. If something erupts there, I very much doubt that even the British who are stirring the pot in all these places, that even they can predict what the fallout and the consequences might be. I think that it all boils down to a long shot hope that if they set fire everywhere, that somehow they're going to be slither out and then in the future impose themselves once again as the you know, the peacemaker and those who write history as, you know, the winning side. Oh, you know, we had nothing whatsoever to do with this. We just came in to bring back peace and stability and, you know, finance reconstruction and development and help everybody, you know, to a new post-World War III global order that they hope that they will be able to dominate again. Except, you know, this time around, unlike World War I and World War II, the Russians, the Chinese, and the Trump administration have understood the British playbook, and I think it's not going to happen quite as easily this time.
I think, Alex, the final goal is the chaos, because the way that you can somehow distract China and Russia, Iran from what they're doing, and India, I would argue, you know, 50% tariffs in India, you know, the only thing that would distract them from what they're doing, it would be chaos. What else do they have?
Yes, exactly, Nima. They have nothing else. They can sow chaos and hope to emerge as victors when, you know, when everybody else destroys themselves mutually. Then if you kept out of the wars, you could preserve yourself and you could emerge as one of the strong players in the aftermath. And, you know, the British foreign policy establishment, and, you know, this is nothing to do with British people. This is the same foreign policy establishment rooted in the financial oligarchy of the City of London. They have been doing this for more than 200 years now. And they have already gotten themselves into a lot of trouble. They've already destroyed their reputation. They've already been unmasked as the world instigator of chaos and wars for everybody to see multiple times in the past. But somehow they've been always able to impose themselves again as, you know, the beacons of civilization and democracy and human rights and the peacemakers. And so I think that they, you know, they always go with this keep calm and carry on. So no matter how bleak the situation is, they continue with their arson attack. They continue with undermining everybody's peace and security and stability because they believe that somehow in the end they will emerge victorious. It doesn't matter how horrible things were. And so what does that mean? What does that imply in the end? In the end, it means that the other side, you know, the other system of governance, which means everybody else, including the populations of the United States, Britain, France, Germany, and so on, you know, the ordinary people everywhere, they have to completely disenfranchise these people, take them out completely, meaning We need a complete overhaul of the monetary system. We need completely new systems of trades, trade settlement, reserve currencies, and security architecture for the world. And I think as dark as things seem these days, I think it's very clear that you have now an emerging alliance between Russia, China, and the United States. I know that it's now become fashionable to hate on Donald Trump, but pay very close attention to what his government is doing. And just in the last few days, you know, Tulsi Gabbard cut out the 4 out of 5 eyes intelligence networks from sharing information about negotiations between United States and Russia. So no more sharing of intelligence with Britain, Canada, Australia, or New Zealand on that very important and very delicate subject. They cut out people like Anthony Blinken. He's apparently now no longer allowed inside any government building. So not only did he lose security clearances, he's not allowed inside government buildings. 37 intelligence professionals lost their security clearances. The whole cabal that was the interdisciplinary team that was thinking up schemes and strategies to antagonize Russia, they've all been disbanded and fired. They launched an attack against George Soros. You know, Trump went out on record on Truth Social that George Soros and Alex Soros, his son, should be arrested and prosecuted. I mean, you know, 8 months ago, this was unthinkable. You could not even mention the name George Soros on mainstream media networks. They would shut you down immediately. So, you know, the Soroses, who are still a notch down in this globalist hierarchy, that you could not even mention them. You could not talk about what they're doing and their activism around the world. Now Trump is openly attacking them, which means that the whole American, you know, state apparatus now has them in their crosshairs. Elon Musk has been vocal about needing to arrest and prosecute Alex and George Soros. And that, you know, that's pretty much a declaration of war on the global financier elites. And this is what Trump has repeatedly promised that he would do. And so now it looks like he's making good on those promises.
Yeah. Alex, before wrapping up, I want to come back to my first question about Austria. And in your opinion, when you look at Europe, can the former Austro-Hungarian states together with Serbia form a counter coalition to resist NATO's forever war strategy?
Nima, yes, I think they could, but it will not be easy to do. Hungary was part of the Austria-Hungary. Hungary already has a mutual defense agreement with Serbia, pretty much a defense pact. Croatia used to be part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, but Croatia is still firmly in the globalist camp, and so is Austria. And these kinds of integration are a threat to the globalist system. And so they will do everything possible to prevent this from happening and to derail the relationships and to try to pit those countries into open warfare one against the other, as they have done in the run up to World War III. You know, the British intelligence services and their secret diplomacy encouraged Serbia through their intelligence network to antagonize Austria-Hungary and to practically force them to intervene in Bosnia and that happened. And this is kind of like the same playbook as, you know, using Ukraine to antagonize Russia into intervening in Ukraine to force a war on them. So this might happen, but I think it'll take time. It'll take time. It'll take determination. And, you know, the people in all these countries are going to have to support these political movements. And, you know, the difficulty is that these political movements today can hardly even articulate these kinds of visions and strategies and platforms, because they get immediately shut down. Assassination is not off the table either. So any leader who, let's say, advocates these kinds of strategies and developments, and who is proposing them to the electorate openly, makes themselves target for assassination. We've seen that with Robert Fico in Slovakia. We've seen leaders in Serbia like Zoran Djindjic. He was assassinated. And we'll see. I think it'll take time.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Alex, for being with us today. Great.
Always a pleasure, Nima. Warm greetings from Croatia to all your viewers. And until the next time, everybody, we're on a good track. We just have to rejoice, stand together, and keep on keeping on.
Yeah, exactly. See you soon, Alex.
Take care. See you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.